Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. In the age of Vermeer, virtuous rivalry was thought to inspire painters to do their best. In contrast, envy or jealous rivalry was painting's greatest enemy. Rembrandt's training and early career provide a context for understanding the foundational nature of friendly artistic competition or emulation. In this lecture, held on October 31, 2017, H. Perry Chapman uses two paintings by Johannes Vermeer, a young woman standing at a virginal and a young woman seated at a virginal, both in the National Gallery, London, as case studies to determine whether such virtuous rivalry could inspire invention and originality. This lecture accompanies the landmark exhibition, Vermeer and the Masters of Genre Painting, Inspiration and Rivalry, on view from October 22, 2017 through January 21, 2018, which examines the artistic exchanges among Johannes Vermeer and his contemporaries from the mid-1650s to around 1680, when they reached the height of their technical ability and mastery of genre painting.
My talk today asks how artistic rivalry, the moral imperative it entailed, the intimacy it engendered, and the kind of comparative thinking it fostered, help us to understand Vermeer's woman standing at a virginal and woman seated at a virginal. Both belong to the National Gallery in London. The painting on the right is on view in the second room of the exhibition. In the mid-17th century Dutch Republic, a network of sophisticated artists, collectors, and dealers at the highest end of the art market created a culture of heightened competition. Artists distinguished themselves and fashioned their images in competition with each other, all the while forging artistic community. Connoisseurs, known as liefhebbers or art lovers, vied with each other in filling their homes, such as these, with costly pictures that were ultimately, in myriad ways, about civility. The paintings in the exhibition were made to hang in houses, not museums. This sanctioned rivalry was part of the cultivation of virtu, or excellence, in a culture that gave moral weight to skill, discernment, expertise, and mutual trust. Close engagement over artistic matters arguably heightened trust and intimacy among and between the painters and the liefhebbers and even the art dealers. For all of these players, comparative viewing heightened intimacy with the work of art. Now, for many years, there's been a debate as to whether or not Vermeer conceived these two paintings as a pair intended to hang together. This lecture argues that they are pendants, that is, a pair, and it explores how they would have been viewed as such in a culture of competitive thinking and comparative viewing. Before I address them, I will consider more broadly why so many Dutch painters were, in effect, looking over each other's shoulders and trying to outdo one another. Vermeer and the Masters of Genre Painting, Inspiration and Rivalry, which started at the Louvre and then moved to Dublin, and here's a viewer in the National Gallery of Ireland, you've got to love her green hair. The exhibition focuses on high life genre paintings, meaning scenes of the daily life, of the manners and customs, real and aspirational, of the urban upper classes, rendered in fine styles with costly pigments. These are paintings of the elite, for the elite, and by the very best artists. The exhibition allows us to scrutinize pictures side by side or nearby in the same gallery, in ways that were impossible for 17th century viewers. Yet the argument of the exhibition is that in Vermeer's time, artists and art lovers were indeed comparing such works, even if they couldn't see them side by side. On the left is the Suitor's Visit of about 1658 by Gerard ter Bork, one of the most inventive and influential of the high life genre painters. On the right is Gabriel Metsu's Man Visiting a Woman Washing Her Hands of the mid-1660s. These bring out a significant contribution of the exhibition, which is to demonstrate that, on occasion, Dutch painters were looking at each other's works, appropriating figures and compositions, and pointedly rivaling each other. Here we can see that Metsu has made a display of creating his own version of Terborch's subject matter composition and elegant domestic setting with its elaborate chimney piece. Most obviously, Metsu has lifted Terborch's protagonists, the young woman who wears a red jacket and Terborch's signature white satin skirt, and the suitor at the door. But he has reversed their roles. Whereas Terborch's suitor is deferential in the face of a confident woman, Metsu has straightened up the man while giving the demure young woman an air of extreme modesty. The man in the background, looking somewhat askance in Terborch's scene, becomes the maid with the knowing glance in Metsu's. The oddity of a woman washing her hands as she receives a visitor just might be explained, maybe, as a clever riposte to Terborch. You're going to find this hard to believe, and scholars disagree about this, but as refined as Terborch's people look, they appear to be communicating with suggestive hand signals. The man makes a circle with his fingers. The woman sticks out a finger between her, I think it's her thumb, between her fingers. Risque touches such as this are typical of Dutch genre painting of the period, although not so common in Terborch. But perhaps the hand washing is Metsu's response. The exhibition is thematic because these painters tended to repeat the same subjects, many of which refer to feminine virtue. In these seemingly naturalistic scenes, the basin and pitcher evoke purity. And by the way, the Vermeer on the right is not in the exhibition. You're just going to have to go to New York to see it. The popular theme of the doctor's visit typically entails a pisskijker, that is, a doctor or a quack, examining a flask of urine as he tends to a sick woman. Here, details that are Dow's invention on the left, such as the weeping woman, indicate that Van Mieris, his pupil, on the right, was pointedly redoing his master's picture. These four pictures of young women making lace, a domestic handicraft that was associated with feminine virtue, show a progression of increased elegance over a short span of time. They are by artists from four different towns. Nicholas Maas painted in Dordrecht in Amsterdam. Caspar Netscher studied with Terborch and Deventer and worked in The Hague. Dow worked in Leiden and Vermeer in Delft. Vermeer's is the only one of these paintings and only one of this theme to feature a special, presumably expensive, lace-making table. And in looking at these closely, we see the contrasting signature styles of Dow and Vermeer. Operating within such a narrow range of subject matter put a premium on distinction and discernment. As painters distinguished themselves through their individual styles and their inventive variations on traditional themes, liefhebbers or connoisseurs developed their connoisseurial skills and powers of discernment. As I said, these pictures were for the elite, which in the Dutch Republic of the 17th century meant largely for the powerful urban merchant and professional governing class, and to a lesser extent for the aristocracy and the stadtholder, the nominal ruler. However, here you see two of the period's most expensive pictures, both of which went to foreign collectors. Dow's Young Mother, which sold for an astounding 4,000 guilders, was part of the Dutch gift to Charles II of England. Frans van Mieris sold the cloth shop on the right for 2,000 guilders to Archduke Leopold Wilhelm of Austria. The Dutch Republic and its painters had flourished in the first half of the 17th century. But by around 1660, the country was entering a period of economic decline, and the market for paintings was pretty saturated. The mid-level painters, who worked for the open market, selling ready-made pictures at fairs, by auction, or in lotteries, were increasingly in trouble. To succeed, it helped if a painter was working at the highest end of the market. Dow, Van Mieris, and Vermeer each had a patron, or more than one patron, who bought a significant number of their works. For example, for an annual stipend, Van Mieris gave the Leiden physician and professor of medicine Franciscus de la Boe Silvius the right of first refusal. In other words, the clientele for these pictures was remarkably sophisticated. For them, viewing was a comparative process. Franz van Mieris's Visitor in a Painter's Studio captures elite practice in that it shows an art lover closely scrutinizing a painting on the artist's easel. This is a picture about connoisseurship. The knowledge necessary for the artist operating at this level is conveyed by the globe, sculpture, and musical instruments. In this context, van Mieris's enigmatic cloth shop, a very unusual subject, becomes a painting about the discernment of beauty of the young woman and quality of the cloth. To the knowledgeable viewer, the profusion of fabrics would have evoked the notion that because of its difficulty, rendering drapery was a test of the painter's skill. The artist's studio also speaks to a culture of visiting studios. From a handful of reports and diaries and other documents, we know that liefhebbers traveled, often in pairs or small groups, from town to town to look at paintings. The Netherlands is a small place, and getting around was pretty easy even in the 17th century. On the right is a Haarlem trekschuit, a public horse-drawn canal boat of the sort that connected many of the Dutch towns by mid-century. And here it is. In the painting in full. Initiated on November 1st, 1657, the barge service from Haarlem to Leiden left from Haarlem's Zijlpoort, or Western Gate, and went as far as halfway, where passengers transferred to the Leiden barge. The wealthy might have had carriages or their own canal boats. So the extent to which painters were looking at and drawing inspiration from each other's works indicates that they were traveling from town to town to visit each other's studios and the homes of collectors and dealers. In these two paintings, we have an instance of travel inspiring rivalry and comparative thinking. In the mid-1660s, Gerrit Dou painted Woman at the Clavichord. Vermeer must have seen Dou's painting in Leiden, about 15 miles away from Vermeer's home of Delft, probably in 1665. That year, Dou's patron, Johan de Bie, had rented rooms on the main street in Leiden in which to display his collection of 27 paintings by Dou. This extraordinary event may well have been the first ever one-man exhibition. It was advertised in the newspaper as open to the public and with a request to put money in the poor box. About 5 years later, Vermeer appropriated Dou's composition of a young woman seated at a keyboard instrument in front of a window in the corner of a room. In each, a viola da gamba suggests that she awaits an accompanist. The inspiring power of emulative imitation, as Erik-Jan Slaughter phrases it in his essay for the exhibition's marvelous catalog, is evident in Vermeer's response to Dou. In the past, we would have discussed the relation between these two paintings in terms of influence, implying a passive reception on the part of Vermeer. Now we know that the concept and practice of emulation, meaning imitation with the aim of transforming and improving upon an admired model, was deeply ingrained in the minds of ambitious artists and discerning viewers. Rivalry drove artistic invention and innovation. It was a recurring topic in the period's writing about art. Some painter writers, and painters did some writing, cautioned against borrowing, but the more sophisticated theorists championed rivalry, at least for the best painters. In the hands of a mediocre painter, borrowing could lead just to weak imitations. In the words of Franciscus Junius in the painting of the Ancients of 1638, "The artists who surpass all others are those who diligently pursue the old art with a new argument, thus adroitly bestowing their paintings with the pleasurable enjoyment of dissimilar similarity." In the words of the Dutch painter Samuel van Hoogstraten, in the introduction to the Academy of Painting of 1678, "It has always been a passion for rivalrous competition which has brought forth so many wonderful masters in art." Until recently, paintings such as these were regarded as conventional, as based in pictorial types and artistic traditions. And indeed, a young woman playing a keyboard instrument was a popular convention that had roots in the 16th century and, for the viewer of the time, carried associations of love. Yet the term conventional implies conservative, which is hard to square with an art that was so fundamentally new, that engaged with a novel kind of subject matter, daily life, in strikingly original ways, and that in its own time was regarded as modern. What the painter theorist Gerard de Lauressa termed the city-like or elegant modern manner was displacing the antique, by which he meant biblical and mythological themes. Yet it nonetheless carried the moral weight of historical paintings because it dealt with matters of virtue, decorum, and, in Lauressa's words, everything that is beautiful and perfect. In the 17th century, as in the Renaissance, productive exchange and competition were deemed essential for the advancement of art and of the elevated artist. Such rivalry had a moral imperative. As for athletes, a competitive drive was thought to inspire individual artists to do their best, to achieve virtu or excellence in their works and in their lives. Samuel van Hoogstraten advised, "Do not hesitate, O pupils, to look at one another's art with, dare I say, envious eyes, yet without offending against the proprieties of an irreproachable life." Van Hoogstraten evoked the peak of the mountain of virtue that was the painter's goal when he wrote that, "Noble envy will impel good minds to the top." But Van Hoogstraten reminds us that rivalry was a double-edged sword. Its dark side is envy, the great metaphorical enemy of the art of painting. In Hendrik Goltzius's Mercury, envy is personified by a hag sticking out her tongue and holding aloft a magpie, the thieving bird attracted to shiny objects. Mercury is part of a large, nearly life-size allegorical triptych showing painting's protectors, which the theoretically minded Goltzius painted for a Harlem lawyer and city administrator. The artist, in the guise of Mercury, god of commerce and eloquence, conquers envy through his persuasive, competitive spirit. Hercules, in the center as virtue, has defeated Calchas, the cattle thief. Minerva at right is wisdom who overcomes ignorance, represented by King Midas. Whereas sanctioned virtuous rivalry inspires invention and innovation, unchecked rivalry or envy leads to bad studio behavior, to cutthroat jealousy, thievery, slander, ignorance, and fisticuffs. 2, Michelangelo's broken nose. Envy was regarded as detrimental to artistic creation because it distorts judgment and prevents one from appreciating the art of others. It blinds the artist to virtue. Hoogstraeten captured the power of virtuous rivalry when he advised, "Let ambition prevent you from sleeping." For virtue also has a way of rousing the passions to zealousness in overtaking the front runner. It is no heresy to outlimb Apelles. Hoogstraeten refers to Apelles, the most famous of the painters from ancient Greece, because artistic rivalry had an illustrious heritage. Dutch painters would have known of the rivalries of the Renaissance masters via the biographies by Giorgio Vasari and Karel van Mander, and of the ancient Greek painters as recounted by Pliny the Elder. They prized above all the story of how Parrhasius got the better of Zeuxis. As the painter Philips Angel told it in his Praise of the Art of Painting of 1642, Zeuxis lured the birds out of the sky with his painted fruit, his imitation of grapes being so natural that the birds flying down to them were deceived. And here are the birds flying down to Zeuxis's grapes. But, Philips Angel continues, Parrhasius, who excelled him as the sun outdoes the moon in radiance and brightness, deceived him with a painted curtain, which Zeuxis tried to remove in order to see Parrhasius's art, not known that he was already seeing it, and he a painter himself. In Pliny's telling, Zeuxis conceded, "I have deceived the birds, but Parrhasius has deceived Zeuxis." Curtains in Dutch paintings often allude to the tale of the competing illusionisms of Zeuxis and Parrhasius. Here we see a friendly, collaborative rivalry at work in a single painting about contrasting realisms by Adrian van der Spelt and Frans van Mieris. Van der Spelt makes a painting, paints the flowers to look as if they are a painting, whereas van Mieris paints a trompe-l'oeil curtain and rod that is meant to practically fool you. In this self-portrait, Gerrit Dou, who was called in his time the Dutch Parrhasius, evoked the tale of Zeuxis and Parrhasius by juxtaposing a birdcage and grapes with a curtain. 2, Dou demonstrates his talent for illusionism and alludes to the long-standing rivalry between painting and sculpture with his near trompe-l'oeil painted niche and relief sculpture below his almost illusionistic, the way his arm comes out at you. Likewise, in The Young Woman at the Clavichord, the birdcage above her head, the curtain, and the grapevine in the lower right corner make explicit the naturalism of the young woman's appeal to the viewer and highlight the signature fine style, miniaturized facture, and curious looseness that cast Dou as nature's rival. However illustrious its roots, rivalry could play out in the most mundane of ways. In his Sleeping Dog, Gerrit Dou pointedly redid Rembrandt's rough sketch-like etching in his inimitable fine manner, and he embellishes Rembrandt's print by adding the basket, jug, bundle of twigs, and wooden shoes. Even here, Dou distinguishes his copiousness from Rembrandt's plainer style. Dou, who was so important to the painters featured in this exhibition, was Rembrandt's first pupil. I bring in Rembrandt because he was trained in and imparted to his students an ethos of virtuous rivalry and a climate of heightened competition. in which artists were encouraged to measure themselves against past masters, outperform their teachers, and productively vie with their contemporaries. These paintings of an Old Testament theme, by Rembrandt's teacher Peter Lastman on the left and Rembrandt on the right, exemplify the notion that the excellent artist surpasses his master through imitation and emulation. Specifically, Rembrandt has pointedly borrowed Lastman, donkey, mule, while rethinking the composition to improve it, to focus the narrative. Encouraging a student to outdo his master was a way to foster stylistic independence at a time when artists needed to distinguish themselves in order to succeed. Lastman appears to have encouraged Rembrandt to develop his own style, just as Rembrandt appears to have done with his students, most of whom departed from their Rembrandtesque manners almost immediately upon setting out on their own. And in turn, Rembrandt's pupil, Samuel van Hoogstraten, recommended that students develop their own styles. The competitive spirit of Lastman's studio was intensified in the young Rembrandt's extraordinary working relationship with the slightly younger but more precocious Jan Leavens, who had also studied with Lastman. For about 6 years, Rembrandt and Leavens worked unusually closely, repeatedly painting or drawing the same subjects. The five senses at the top shows that Leavens was initially the more accomplished painter. Rembrandt's earliest known works, the four wonderfully expressive but rather crude panels below, reprise Leavens's allegory by giving the senses the innovative theme of quasi-medicinal cures. Sight at left is the spectacle cellar. Smell is smelling salts. Touch is the stone operation, a remedy for madness. And hearing is music, a balm for the soul and cure for melancholy. Their paintings of the raising of Lazarus of a few years later demonstrate how collaboration inspired artistic breakthrough. Rembrandt and Leavens' studio ethos of self-imposed competition produced one of the great rivalries in the history of art. And if you're interested in reading about artistic rivalries, I recommend Rona Goffin's Renaissance Rivals, which tell you all about Michelangelo and Raphael, and Sebastian Smee's The Art of Rivalry, about rivalries between Francis Bacon and Lucian Freud, Degas and Manet, Matisse and Picasso, and Jackson Pollock and Willem de Kooning. Presumably, Rembrandt's and Leavens' extraordinarily close working relationship had at its heart a great friendship. The humanist notion of friendship carried connotations of virtue, stemmed from Cicero and Aristotle, and was expressed in Erasmus's adages, "Friendship is equality, and a friend is a second self." We can only imagine, though, the dynamic of working side by side, the excitement of competing neck and neck, the intimacy and pain of being open to criticism and comparison. But we can see the transformative impact of rivalry as Rembrandt and Leavens came into their own, or I think I should say, as Rembrandt surpassed Leavens. The melodramatic arms of Lazarus. Have you spotted them? Here's Lazarus, his arms sticking up from the tomb. To me, exemplify Leavens' increasing tendency to kind of over-dramatize and cut corners. Who knows whether it was the intensity of their rivalry that by 1631 led both to leave Leiden and go their separate ways. We do know, however, that 25 years later, these two paintings hung together in Rembrandt's house. One of their last painted rivalries took the form of an organized, sanctioned competition. Rembrandt and Leavens' strikingly similar paintings of Christ on the cross, which emulate a model by Peter Paul Rubens, suggests that Constantine Haukens orchestrated for the two to compete for a commission for the Stadtholder. This is all getting too far into Rembrandt and Leavens, but a little bit more of Rembrandt. Gerrit Dou, who in 1628, at age 14, signed on as Rembrandt's first pupil, grew up in this climate of intense rivalry. Near the end of his apprenticeship, Dou boldly subverted Rembrandt's artist in his studio to create a contrasting notion of the painter. Rembrandt, on the left, crafted the studio as a spare and solitary place, and as the site of inspiration, signaled by the light that floods in and hits the front of the panel on his easel. Dou's light-struck easel is a nod to Rembrandt's. But otherwise, Dou made his picture bigger, he brought the painter to the fore, and he added emblematic accoutrements of the ideal painter. Books and classical sculpture signal his knowledge. The lute inspires. A globe evokes his universality. In contrast to Rembrandt's artist alone in his studio, Dou's painter inhabits a place of intellectual and artistic discourse, suitable for receiving appreciative leafheavers. Dou and Rembrandt continued to inspire each other. With his self-portrait of 1647 on the right, Dou made a display of rethinking his master's self-portrait of 1640, which is a tremendously famous self-portrait at the time. In Dou's, the sculpture of Hercules overcoming Caucus stands for virtue's triumph over envy. Dou claims noble envy, the kind of virtuous rivalry that spurred creative competition among friends. Dou and Rembrandt each achieved the height of fame, with Rembrandt becoming the master of the rough style and Dou becoming the master of the fine manner. Rivalry and emulation encouraged artistic community. Through self-portraits, Rembrandt's pupils, Dou, Govert Flinck, and Ferdinand Bol, among others, paid homage to their master by producing their own original variations on Rembrandt's 1640 self-portrait. So, with Rembrandt and Leavens, we saw an instance of youthful extreme rivalry. Rembrandt and Dou began as master and pupil and for decades engaged with each other on occasion. In the case of Vermeer, we know nothing about his education, and we must rely largely on his works to understand his exchange with other painters such as Dou. Vermeer has been regarded as one of the most original and independent of the high life genre painters, and indeed he is. Yet the exhibition reveals him to be interested in and dependent on the art of his contemporaries. To understand his originality, we need to see his works in 17th century terms as aiming for dissimilar similarity. Woman Standing and Woman Seated at a Virginal, which date from the early 1670s, show how a competitive spirit inspired late career creativity. Although it has often been proposed that Vermeer painted these as pendants meant to hang together, the counter-arguments have prevailed. These are, they're two similar subject matter, they're differing provenances, but going only back to the 18th century, and they're very slightly different sizes, really only within what we would call the margin of error. And they're supposedly having been painted a couple of years apart, although they are undated. Typically, they hang and have for years hung in separate rooms at the National Gallery in London. Technical analysis, fairly recent, specifically computer analysis of the canvas weave, and this, I won't explain it here because that would take a little too long. You're going to have to trust me that the image on the right maps the average distances between the warp threads. And what it indicates is that the canvases are from the same bolt of cloth. well, they're able to figure this out, which is totally amazing, which increases the likelihood. It by no means proves it, but increases the likelihood that Vermeer painted these two paintings at the same time, as does the fact that they were painted on canvases prepared with the same grounds. The iconographic argument, that is the argument based on subject matter, that they form a pair, put forward in the 1970s by the late Christine Armstrong, is that they evoke contrasting notions of love. Virtuous love, a domesticized version of sacred love, is embodied in the woman standing upright in a room washed with light. The picture within the picture is based on this emblem from Otto von Wayne's popular Amorum Emblemata, or love emblems, and it is captioned, "Perfect love is for one person only." And it shows a Cupid holding up a card in the print with the one on it. This image of virtuous love is contrasted with profane or illicit love, embodied in the seated woman who wears darker clothes in a dimly lit room with drawn shades. On the wall hangs Dirk van Baburen's Procurus, a lusty painting about prostitution. The man offers a coin to the young woman. This painting belonged to Vermeer's mother-in-law. And note that Vermeer has picked up the blue and white from the prostitute's dress. Armstrong argued that the contrasting two mountain landscapes in the woman standing and the flat landscape in the woman seated reinforce this contrast of innocence versus experience by evoking the high road to virtue and the low road to vice. This distinction between high road and low derives from the imagery of the crossroads, where Hercules must choose between sacred love at left, who points to the mountain of virtue, and profane love, the scantily clothed voluptas, who lures him to the path of vice. Annibale Carracci's famous painting was circulating in print by this time, but there are many other images. Vermeer's response to Dow's painting demonstrates how emulative imitation, or dissimilar similarity, makes the conventional original. Dow had already innovated within the convention by featuring the young woman alone, often there's a music teacher or people making music with her, and looking directly out at us, which was quite unusual. Vermeer, in turn, at once displayed his appreciation of Dow's address to the viewer and improved upon it by closing in on the woman to heighten our intimacy with the picture. Vermeer also pushes the viola da gamba out towards us, making the picture's invitation to the viewer accompanist more emphatic. Finally, Vermeer makes it a darker evening scene. Vermeer's handling of paint and rendering the gilt frame, clothes, and instruments seems calculated to contrast with Dow's fine manner, as if Vermeer is defining his optical style and broadening it some in opposition to Dow's descriptive illusionism. Vermeer also moderates Dow's pleasing decorative richness, which Phillips Angell, for whom Dow was the exemplary painter, recommended as a way for the painter to make money and attract attention. And Dow, by the way, charged by the hour. An old-fashioned way, well, a number of artists did, but it was still an old-fashioned way of pricing, but one that emphasized the time-consuming detail for which Dow was famed. Reportedly, he painted with a brush with a single hair and took 3 days to paint a single broom. Vermeer rejects Dow's painting of lots of stuff for painting light, and he rejects Dow's artificiality for naturalness. In these pictures of women adorning themselves before a mirror, we see that contrast of Vermeer's plain elegance and Dow's copiousness and decorative richness. Angell rightly predicted these features would ensure that Dow's pictures would fetch the highest prices and appeal to the most refined buyers. Is it possible that Dow was responding to Vermeer's painting here? Vermeer's woman is in profile. She looks in a mirror. We just glimpse its shimmer in the frame between the windows as she ties the ribbons of her necklace. Dow ingeniously shows his woman in profile with her hands in front of her and in full face as he demonstrates that he can imitate both real flesh and blood and the visage as distorted by the reflective surface. For the woman standing at a virginal, Vermeer drew on the duet by Franz von Mieris, an influential painting that must have been available for many to view. Vermeer enhances the focus on the woman by eliminating the other figures. The page becomes the Cupid on the wall. He turns her around. Was he thinking of pairing her with the seated woman? So that the chair becomes an invitation to an admirer. He also improves upon von Mieris's use of the geometry of the picture frame around the painting hanging on the wall to draw attention to her head. And he provides a source for the light that illuminates the front of von Mieris's woman. As Vermeer brightens the room, he casts the woman's face in shadow to emphasize her modesty. If, as I'm arguing, these were pendants, then let's also consider how rivalry affects our understanding of how they work together. As a pair, they show Vermeer emulating two masters, or three if we include Bab Orin. They also show Vermeer rivaling himself, and they demand comparison with each other. Vermeer had already featured Bab Orin's painting in the concert, so it's almost a decade later in The Woman Seated that he reprises the concert in which Bab Orin's Procurus serves as a foil or a provocative comment on a seemingly chaste threesome making music. Rethinking the music making theme, Vermeer zeroes in on the young woman at the keyboard who is no longer so demure. Again, he uses Bab Orin's painting to inspire comparative thinking or comparative viewing to help characterize the young musician, but also to leave us uncertain as to what exactly to draw from that comparison. Two, I guess I would say more typical pairs of paintings in the exhibition present the viewer with narratives about correspondence. In Gerard Terborch's pendants, an officer writes a letter and a young woman seals her response. In Metsu's pair, the man writes the letter that the woman then reads, or Arthur has a different argument about this because he's hung them in the opposite way. Whichever, the maid, pulling aside the curtain, enhances the narrative with a bit of humor, for she uncovers a picture of a ship at sea, which suggests that she already knows the letter's contents. Telltale pictures of ships in either calm or stormy seas were standard features of love letter imagery. Vermeer, in contrast, provides no narrative. Instead, he issues a challenge to compare. Side by side, the two pictures vie for our attention. I'm told that they hang in different rooms in London because the public looks at the lighter, brighter picture and ignores the other. However, to the Liefheber, attentive to painting style and practice, they would have presented a unique test in discernment. To those connoisseurs who especially valued naturalism, they would have demonstrated Vermeer's prowess in representing daylight versus nightlight, which would expand the notions of true versus illicit love. The more schematic handling of the young woman seated has been interpreted as a couple of years' stylistic difference. Yet this is Vermeer's only dark, maybe night scene, and differences between it and the young woman standing seem calculated to bring out the contrast between bright natural light and low-level artificial light. The daylit frame sparkles brightly, whereas the artificially lit frame glows, its rhythmic dashes of paint creating the effect of flickering candlelight. Babourin's Procurus suggests that Vermeer aim to rival Caravaggesque lighting. Likewise, Vermeer has varied his painting of their clothes. In daylight, the satin skirt is crisp and shiny. The silver-gray trim on the woman's sleeves sparkles with highlights. These are the circles of confusion ascribed to viewing through a camera obscura, which Vermeer transformed into a signature stylistic feature. In dimmer light, the silvery trim has fewer dots of light, and the blue overskirt appears more softly sensuous. Viewers in the know would have been especially attentive to the picture's contrasting themes and the two lovely, refined young women who vie for our attention. The upright, modest young woman standing looks thoughtful. It's amazing what a bit of shadow can do. In contrast, the woman seated with her direct gaze seems more open and engaged, suggesting that perhaps she's not so modest. And by no means do I think we're meant to liken her to Babourin's buxom prostitute. But then again, I don't think she's the absolute opposite of that prostitute. As a pair, Vermeer's paintings present the 17th century viewer and us with a choice between the high road and the low. They are not so much didactic as efficacious, immediate and intimate. Their effect is to subtly instill manners, civility, and ethical human behavior by gently demanding that we ask, am I going to behave moderately or immodestly? Am I going to fall for the allure of nocturnal desire? Rivalry engendered the dissimilar similarity of Vermeer's extraordinarily intimate London paintings. Whether sold together or not, they must have been developed comparatively in Vermeer's mind and studio. For only as a vying pair do they set each other off and make each other better. And only as a pair do they prompt such a profound meditation on light and dark, innocence and experience, virtue and vice. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.